This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Today, Michael Cohen, President Trump's former attorney and longtime fixer, testifies before the House Oversight Committee just months before he begins serving a 3-year prison sentence.
I am ashamed that I chose to take part in concealing Mr. Trump's illicit acts rather than listening to my own conscience.
In his opening remarks, Cohen calls the president
racist, he is a con man, and he is a cheat. Mr. Trump knew of and directed the Trump-Moscow negotiations. Mr. Trump is a racist. Mr. Trump would often say, this campaign was going to be the greatest infomercial in political history. Within a couple of days, there would be a massive dump of emails that would damage Hillary Clinton's campaign. Mr. Trump responded by stating to the effect, wouldn't that be great? Says to me something to the effect of, don't worry, Michael, your January and February reimbursement checks are coming. I have been smeared as a rat. Directed me to threaten his high school, his colleges, and the college board to never release his grades. Individual number one is President Donald J. Trump.
Ilya Marritz has been watching the testimony from here in New York City, and he's a reporter for WNYC and co-host of the Trump Inc. podcast. Ilya, thank you so much for being with us.
Good to be here.
This is the day. So, Ilya, what are some of the broad patterns that we're seeing in the questions today? Because I feel like there are two strategies that we're seeing emerge, one from the Democrats, one from the Republicans. We'll start with the Democrats. They seem to be trying to paint Donald Trump as the villain.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of different directions, and we keep kind of looping back to those. But, you know, at the center of it all is Donald Trump's judgment, Donald Trump's potential legal exposure, what other parties might have on Donald Trump, and really trying to understand his motivations, how he ran his company. With the Republicans, there's been a lot of talk about Lanny Davis, a lot of talk about a potential book deal. Justin Amash, I think, has been the only one so far that's really had substantive questions about Donald Trump
himself.
And that's really telling because none of the Republicans are out there really defending the president around the things that Cohen is saying. They're simply trying to ding his credibility. And for the most part, he's saying, look, I pleaded to the stuff. I'm going to jail for a substantial amount of time. But if you would like, I can talk to you about what I know about Donald Trump, who I worked for 10 years.
It would be no different if I said, that's the nicest looking tie I've ever seen, isn't it? What are you going to do? You're going to fight with him? The answer is no. So you say, yeah, it's the nicest looking tie I've ever seen. That's how he speaks. He doesn't give you questions. He doesn't give you orders. He speaks in a code. And I understand the code because I've been around him for a decade.
I wanted to add one of the really interesting points that emerged in the last hour or so of testimony had to do with Cohen's earlier prepared testimony to Congress, which he wrote with his lawyer and then shared with Donald Trump's lawyers. And according to Cohen, they edited his testimony.
There were changes made, additions, Jay Sekulow for one.
Were there changes about the timing? The question of the
gentleman's time has expired. You may answer that question.
There were several changes that were made, including how we were going to handle that message.
Were you finished?
Yes. The message, of course, being the length of time that the Trump Tower Moscow project stayed and remained alive.
That opens up a lot of very surprising possibilities, especially if the edits that they suggested were some kind of cover up or if they were inserting lies. Now, Cohen has already said that his testimony was false and he's going to jail for the false testimony. Nevertheless, if Donald Trump's, if the U.S. president's lawyers were making Cohen's testimony more false than it already was, that's really a thing. That's like a whole new area of legal exposure that we have hardly begun to contemplate.
It's we're on air, so people can't see our eyes sort of like bulging, but I'm just thinking like this is really crazy. Let's talk a little bit about some of the actual back and forth. Earlier today, we saw Democratic Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz of Florida ask Cohen specifically about the connection between Trump and the Trump family and Russia. Let's take a listen.
If Mr. Trump and his daughter Ivanka and son Donald Jr. are involved in the Russian Trump Tower deal, Is it possible the whole family is conflicted or compromised with a foreign adversary in the months before the election?
Yes.
Ilya.
Yeah, I think the person who might have the most headaches coming out of this is Donald Trump Jr., because he has already given sworn testimony around this stuff. And so if he perjured himself, if Michael Cohen is telling the truth that Donald Trump Jr. was repeatedly briefed on this and very involved, and if Donald Trump Jr. said something contrary to that to law enforcement or to the Congress, that creates a lot of problems for Donald Trump Jr. That moment was also very... had a lot of built-in drama for people who have been watching this for a while, because Debbie Wasserman Schultz, of course, was the chair of the DNC. Her emails were among those that were hacked. She was actually forced to step down, I believe, during the Democratic convention in 2016. And you could hear a little tremor in her voice during that questioning as she was kind of homing in on those issues.
So we also heard Democratic Representative Raja Krishnamoorthy of Illinois ask Michael Cohen about the last time he had contact with Donald Trump and one of his associates. Let's take a listen.
Unfortunately, this topic is actually something that's being investigated right now by the Southern District of New York. And I've been asked by them not to discuss and not to talk about these issues.
Fair enough. Is there any other wrongdoing or illegal act that you are aware of regarding Donald Trump that we haven't yet discussed today?
Yes, and again, those are part of the investigation that's currently being looked at by the Southern District of New York.
Any sense, Ilya, what Cohen could be referring to there?
It's going to be really hard for the headline writers to pick a headline out of these hearings, but I think this might be the best one. We did not know that the Southern District was apparently investigating the president. We don't know what the contents of it are, but there is a clue here, because Congressman Krishnamoorthy had asked about Cohen's last communication with Donald Trump, when it took place and what it was about. And Cohen, I think, said it was late summer of 2018. The years are blending together, but that he's been asked not to discuss it because it's subject of an ongoing investigation. And Cohen is cooperating on an ongoing basis with Southern District prosecutors. Interestingly, if his cooperation is fruitful, Cohen may be eligible for some kind of sentencing reduction. We don't know that much about it, and a lot of that hinges on whether Cohen's information is good and whether it leads somewhere, but he does have an incentive to talk.
Ilya Marritz is a reporter for WNYC and co-host of the Trump Inc. podcast. Thank you for being with us again.
Thanks so much.
Mr. Cohen, you called Donald Trump a cheat in your opening testimony. What would you call yourself?
A fool. I am a non-government employee. It was not lobbying, and they are not
foreign. This has nothing to do with lobbying.
How many times did Mr. Trump ask you to threaten an individual or entity on his behalf?
Quite a few times.
50 times?
More.
100 times?
More.
200 times?
More.
500 times?
Probably.
Did you not wiretap President Trump without his knowledge?
I did record Mr. Trump in a conversation, yes.
You don't know truth from falsehood.
I'm responsible for your silliness because I did the same thing that you're doing now for 10 years. I protected Mr. Trump for 10 years.
Now we turn to two more people who've been following Michael Cohen's trajectory alongside President Trump. Amy Sabrin is a former defense attorney at Skadden Arps, where she represented many public officials and executives in Department of Justice investigations and congressional investigations. And Rebecca Davis O'Brien is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal.
I was struck by his description of the president, broadly speaking. This is somebody who once said he would take a bullet for the president, who's now sort of in very vivid strokes describing him as a liar, a racist, sort of an inveterate crook who he says he regretted following for so long.
There are three major takeaways. One, Cohen says Trump conspired to violate campaign finance laws and provides evidence of that.
I am providing the committee today with several documents, and these include a copy of a check Mr. Trump wrote from his personal bank account after he became president to reimburse me for the hush money payments I made to cover up his affair with an adult film star and to prevent damage to his campaign.
2, Trump knew of Russia's efforts to hack into Hillary Clinton's and DNC emails and encouraged it.
Days before the Democratic convention, I was in Mr. Trump's office when his secretary announced that Roger Stone was on the phone. Mr. Trump put Mr. Stone on the speakerphone. Mr. Stone told Mr. Trump that he had just gotten off the phone with Julian Assange, and that Mr. Assange told Mr. Stone that within a couple of days, there would be a massive dump of emails that would damage Hillary Clinton's campaign. Mr. Trump responded by stating to the effect, "Wouldn't that be great?"
And 3, Trump lied about Russia and his Moscow project throughout the campaign, so Cohen did too.
Mr. Trump knew of and directed the Trump-Moscow negotiations throughout the campaign and lied about it. He lied about it because he never expected to win.
What does that tell us, Amy?
Well, it tells us that Trump lied to the American people throughout the campaign, if Cohen is to be believed. I presume that he's not the only one who has evidence of this. And it also raises questions about Trump's role in the lies that Mr. Cohen made to Congress when he first testified. And it doesn't directly implicate the president in directing Cohen to lie about those negotiations. But he said that he ran his testimony, his written testimony, by Trump's personal lawyers. And the implication there is that either they knew he was lying or that they ran it past Trump and Trump approved it. But he doesn't provide direct evidence that Trump directed him to lie in that testimony.
And Amy, you said if he is to be believed, and I think that's a huge question today. This is someone who admits to having lied in the past. Is there something that we should be looking for that will say this is the moment we can believe Michael Cohen?
Well, first of all, he's bringing some corroborating documentary evidence. Second of all, he wouldn't have reason to testify falsely today. He has every incentive to testify truthfully because he could face more jail time if he lies, and I'm sure his lawyers have made that clear to him. And third of all, Cohen's willing to answer any questions thrown toward him and to experience withering cross-examination from the Republicans under penalty of perjury, which is more than you can say for President Trump.
There's another issue here. Cohen says that Donald Trump also knew when he was a presidential candidate that Roger Stone, and we'll get into the details of Roger Stone later in the show, was talking to Julian Assange about the WikiLeaks drop of DNC emails. Is that a direct implication, Amy?
That, again, is circumstantial evidence of conspiring in the DNC email hacks, but it's not direct evidence, and it doesn't tie him directly. He knows someone else is doing it. Cohen says he encouraged it, but again, it's not the smoking gun.
I want to pivot for a little bit, Amy. Yesterday evening, Representative Matt Gaetz from Florida tweeted out, and I'm quoting here, "Hey, at Michael Cohen 212, do your wife and father-in-law know about your girlfriends? Maybe tonight would be a good time for that chat." And he goes on and on to ask him about, you know, whether or not she'll remain faithful when you're in prison. You know, is this witness intimidation, Amy? And if it is, what should Congress do about it?
Well, it could be something that Congress wants to take disciplinary action in connection with. You know, if Congressman Gaetz had left that message on Cohen's private voicemail, you might say it was closer to witness intimidation. The fact that he does it publicly raises a question about that. Also, you have to remember that members of Congress have immunity from criminal prosecution. It's called the Speech or Debate Clause. It's in the Constitution for conduct conducted while in connection with their official duties. There's a question that's never been resolved whether tweeting or, you know, is within their official duties, but he could be immune from prosecution, even if it is witness tampering.
Rebecca, let's take a step back and talk about a little bit more about the relationship between these two men, Trump and Cohen. How far back does their relationship go?
Well, we know that Michael Cohen started working for Donald Trump approximately a decade ago at Trump Organization and took on different roles, but most recently served as the president's personal lawyer. Michael Cohen seems to be the person to whom he turned for assistance on the side of, you know, legal assistance. He was an enforcer type for him, a fixer.
I'm talking about a man who declares himself brilliant, but directed me to threaten his high school, his colleges, and the college board to never release his grades or SAT scores.
Look, I cover white-collar law enforcement, and there are times when people who work on behalf of very powerful people do kind of bully their way around. It's not unusual to that dynamic. It's, as Michael Cohen points out, it's a little ironic because at the time then Donald Trump was criticizing President Obama for being, you know, lazy student or a bad student. So he's a bully on behalf of, he was a bully, and he, I think he acknowledges that.
Sitting here today, it seems unbelievable that I was so mesmerized by Donald Trump that I was willing to do things for him that I knew were absolutely wrong.
And he feels bad that he played that role.
We're now seeing a very contrite Mr. Cohen, and I'd love to ask both of you, why do you think Michael Cohen flipped the script? Rebecca.
We wrote about that a little bit last year. One thing that happened right after, in April, you guys recall, it feels like a zillion years ago, there was this FBI raid of his hotel, home, and office. And that really just blew this investigation by the Southern District of New York into the open. And as soon as it became apparent that he was under criminal investigation, of course, the contours of that investigation weren't known yet, a divide immediately emerged. I think there were already strains there. We've reported that one reason he pleaded guilty was that his family was being threatened with some legal exposure in connection with his personal businesses and their applications to banks. He has professed to be, you know, particularly close to his family, and he's protective of them and feels like they've been threatened.
As my father said countless times throughout my childhood, you, my wife, and you, my children, are the air that I breathe. So to my Laura and to my Sammy and to my Jake, there's nothing I wouldn't do to protect you.
I also think that, you know, Trump's legal team sort of pushed him away. I don't think they felt like embracing him. They kind of left him out in the cold, and that was a strategy.
Amy, and of course, depending on who you ask, Michael Cohen's guilty plea was either proof of collusion or evidence of the president's innocence. Amy, what does the case against Cohen and the fact that ultimately he is going to jail actually tell us?
Well, most of the reason he's going to jail is five counts of personal income tax evasion. So it tells us that he has been dishonest in many of his dealings in the past. But he, as he put it, he is going to jail for felonies that he committed for the benefit of and at the direction of and in coordination with individual one, who he makes clear is President Donald J. Trump.
Amy, you talked about Michael Cohen, and I'm wondering if the information that he provided to Bob Mueller would actually get him a reduced sentence here in the Southern District of New York. How does the district court see this?
Well, I think he's already been sentenced. I think he got 3 years on the charges that the Southern District of New York brought against him. And he got 30 days, I believe, for lying to Congress to be served concurrently with those 3 years. So there was a little bit of a difference between how he was viewed by Mueller's team and how he was viewed by the Southern District in terms of his level of cooperation.
And I'm wondering, Rebecca, even, you know, with Cohen's help with the special counsel, the Southern District of New York doesn't seem pretty impressed with this. They've called it modest. His help is modest. They've also recommended, quote, a substantial term of imprisonment. These two offices have seemed to come to very different conclusions. Why is that?
Well, this came out during his sentencing or in the weeks before his sentencing. The Southern District did say that, you know, they believe Mueller's office when they say that Michael Cohen provided substantial assistance. And they did say that. The special counsel's prosecutors said that he was very helpful. At the same time, Southern District said he did not choose to cooperate until it was very close to the end. And secondly, he chose not to take a formal cooperation deal. This is complicated, but in the Southern District of New York, the way this typically works is you have to come clean about everything you've ever done, any crime you've ever committed. Otherwise, you can't be a cooperator in that traditional sense. And Michael Cohen said it was because he wanted to begin. He knew he was going to go to prison. It was going to happen soon. He had to get it done with. He didn't want to go through this whole process. You can read into whatever you want for that. People certainly have. He's a, you know, guy with a long career involving some shady businesses. and in and around New York and elsewhere. He chose not to cooperate fully, and that's why he's getting 3 years.
Amy, when we say 3 years, potentially, what could that realistically look like for someone like Michael Cohen? Are we talking about a potential for a reduced sentence, for good behavior? Are we talking about low security prison? Like, what is this actually going to look like for Cohen?
We're talking about a low security prison, most likely. The Bureau of Prisons makes a recommendation in that regard. And we're talking about something less than 3 years, but probably not much. There's not much reduction for good behavior in the federal system.
Well, there's a lot to pay attention to today, so we appreciate both of you coming in. Attorney Amy Sabrin and Rebecca Davis O'Brien with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks to you both on this big day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Michael Cohen may be the central figure from President Trump's world in the national spotlight today, but the president's children are also tied up in multiple investigations, namely for their work with the Trump family business. Andrea Bernstein is senior editor at WNYC and co-host of the Trump Inc. podcast and the person that we have on to help us understand these things. Andrea, thank you for being with us today.
Always so great.
So much to unpack. Let's start with how the Trump children were involved in the failed deal for Trump Tower in Moscow. And I want to play you a clip of Donald Trump Jr. talking about what he knew last month.
The reality is this wasn't a deal. You know, we don't know the developer. We don't know the site. We don't know anything about it. Ultimately, it was Michael Cohen essentially trying to get a deal done. You know, he was there for a long time. He wasn't exactly a deal guy. He didn't bring too many to the table. So I don't think anyone took it all that seriously. That's the reality of what went on.
Is that realistic?
Well, the reality is there was a deal. There was a signed letter of intent signed by a certain Donald J. Trump in October of 2015 on the day, as it happens, of one of the Republican primary debates. So there was a deal. I mean, it wasn't a done deal, but it was a letter of intent that they were going to go forward. And according to the special counsel's office and BuzzFeed News very helpfully released hundreds of pages of emails that show that this is something that was discussed by Trump associates right up almost until the nominating convention.
Now, let's talk a little bit about what would be the interest in Trump having this tower in Moscow? I mean, was it purely an ego play or was there more to this?
Well, it's something that Trump had been talking about, we know, and exploring for literally decades. We know that Trump was interested. What we don't know, we have only Michael Cohen's testimony as relayed to us in his plea agreement with the special counsel's office that he briefed Trump and his family members many times and all through the course of these negotiations. So we don't have any email evidence as to Don Jr., as to Ivanka, as to Eric, but that is one of the things that we may be learning more about.
Now, we also know that the children you just mentioned, the three names here, they are now, how have their jobs evolved since their father has taken office?
Well, I think it's important to think about what was happening in this late period of the Trump Organization. By late period, I mean the period right before the presidency. So there's a number of executive vice presidents for development and acquisitions. Three of them are Don Jr., Ivanka, and Eric Trump. The most important of these people, whose last name is not Trump, is Michael Cohen. And these are the people that are seeking and putting together the deals in this period. Right after Donald Trump is elected, of course, his daughter Ivanka comes to the White House. Eric and Don Jr. are put in charge of the company. But Donald Trump still takes profits. He can still get checks. So there's no meaningful separation between his presidency and his family business to this day.
Andrea, we talked about the Trump children here. I'm wondering if we could pivot a minute to the Trump business. It's 2 years after the presidency. You said these are still not two separate entities. How is the business doing as a whole?
Well, so the business is complicated because there are places like New York, Panama, Toronto, where his name has come off buildings, where there is not a clientele. But there are other places, most noticeably the Trump Hotel in Washington, that all kinds of foreign leaders, lobbyists, members of the administration, political committees are spending all kinds of money there. So it's a mixed bag. And because we don't have his tax returns, we don't have the complete picture.
That little document, right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What we do have from today's testimony is dramatic new details about what the non-separation of the business and the White House looks like. So Michael Cohen, in his opening statement, says that he went to the White House in early 2017, and there he is, and Trump's showing him the Oval Office, and he's showing him these portraits. And he says, "Don't worry, your check is coming." And he's referring to the reimbursement check for Michael Cohen's hush money payments. And this is Trump, according to Michael Cohen, telling Cohen this in the White House. And he says, "Don't worry, your check is delayed because it takes a while for the FedEx to get through the White House." So that is what the non-separation looks like, according to Michael Cohen, that there are checks flowing from the Trump Organization to the White House. Trump's using his personal account sometimes. Business accounts are used other times. All of this to reimburse Cohen for these illegal payments to the women who said they had affairs with Donald Trump to keep them quiet during the campaign.
Cohen also talks in his opening statement about how Donald Trump sort of inflated his assets when it was important to him. He mentions the checks. There are now copies of these checks circulating online. Can you tell us a little bit more about that, particularly in where Deutsche Bank comes
into this? Right, so we've seen this a lot in Trump Inc. We've seen many, many cases where Donald Trump will deflate the value of his assets. For example, when he doesn't want to pay taxes, but inflate the value when he wants people to buy in and or when he wants a bank loan. And Michael Cohen is saying in his opening statement, yeah, that happened. I've got the receipts. This is what they did. And they did it specifically to evade paying taxes.
And we know there's also a little bit more in the Trump Organization. The New York City AG has already shut down the Trump Foundation. But they've promised to investigate the Trump Organization, which are obviously two separate things. What's happening there? What can we expect?
So with the foundation, what we're waiting to find out now is the AG has asked for fines and also for Don Jr., Ivanka, Eric, and Donald Trump to be barred from serving on charitable boards. But what is important is the picture that has emerged. Again, no separation between the campaign, the charity, the business, and that, the attorney general says, is illegal. And it may be illegal, and it may be connecting all of these things, the foundation, the business, and the presidency. And that's what we're learning about today as Michael Cohen makes his testimony before Congress.
And I recall the Trump administration did try to address this early on. I recall a table with many documents on it at one point and a lawyer saying that these two things were separate. So that never happened? Was it us that we kept our eye off the ball? What happened?
We believe all those folders were full of empty papers, that there was no meaningful separation between Donald Trump and his company, simply a day-to-day organizational, but not where it counts, which is financial. And Donald Trump is still making money. And you can hear about one of the ways in the newly released episode of the Trump Inc. podcast on his Washington, D.C. hotel, which shows just how foreign officials are going in and spending money to try to get the attention of the U.S. president.
Well, and as you said, Michael Cohen literally has the receipts today, so we'll watch out for that. Andrea Bernstein is a senior editor at WNYC and co-host of the Trump Inc. podcast. We encourage you all to listen. The web of the Mueller investigation extends far beyond Michael Cohen and the Trump family.
President Trump's former campaign chairman, Paul Manafort.
Former campaign aide, George Papadopoulos.
President Trump's former national security advisor, Michael Flynn.
Longtime Donald Trump advisor, Roger Stone.
Konstantin Kalimnik, a Russian political consultant.
13 Russian nationals and 3 Russian companies.
I heard some names thrown around before that were hangers-on or on the campaign.
To date, 34 different people have been indicted by Robert Mueller and his team of investigators, and 5 of them have agreed to guilty pleas. It's a lot of names and changes to wrap your head around, and thankfully, Andrew Prokop is here to help lay it all out for us. He's a senior politics correspondent for Vox. Andrew, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's get started with the most recent indictment to come out of the Mueller investigation. Remember this guy, Roger Stone? What information was revealed in his indictment?
So Roger Stone was charged with lying to Congress and withholding information and trying to intimidate a witness regarding the 2017 House Intelligence Committee investigation into Russian interference with the campaign. Specifically, this was about Stone's statements about WikiLeaks. And there's still a lot of mystery here because the indictment lays out various emails Stone exchanged with others about what Julian Assange may have been planning regarding releasing the hacked emails of Clinton campaign chairman John Podesta. But it's still not entirely clear what Stone knew, how he got it, and especially what Donald Trump knew. And that's becoming more important today because this is one of the issues that Cohen is going to address in his testimony.
So we've ticked off Michael Cohen, we've ticked off Roger Stone, and now we're going to enter another name, Paul Manafort. What is the latest with his former Trump, with the former Trump campaign chairman?
So Manafort was charged with financial crimes and lobbying disclosure crimes related to his lobbying for the former government of Ukraine. And he was convicted at trial, eventually struck a plea deal, and then agreed to cooperate with Mueller. But that cooperation has fallen apart. There have been accusations from Mueller that Manafort deliberately lied. And a judge sided with Mueller on several of these counts and found that it was persuasive that Manafort lied to investigators. And I think the most important of the instances that Mueller alleged here is that Manafort, he says, lied about sharing internal Trump campaign polling data with Konstantin Kalimnik, who is a Russian national who the government says has ties to Russian intelligence. So this is a pretty big example, if it is corroborated, of someone very high up in the Trump campaign, the chairman, Paul Manafort, having contacts with somebody tied to Russian intelligence and giving important information. We don't know why he gave that information. Some have speculated it was just Manafort's efforts to line up future business for himself. But the other possibility is that he wanted something in return, that he was trying to ask or better inform Russian interference efforts on perhaps social media propaganda.
Well, you mentioned the next name I was going to ask you about. Here we go. Konstantin Kalimnik, for those of you keeping track at home, who is a Russian political operative who's connected to Paul Manafort. We don't know a lot about this guy. I mean, even when you Google him, there's like one picture that kind of floats around. Like, how mm-hmm. key is he to this investigation?
So Kalimnik worked with Manafort for over a decade in this Ukraine work, and it appears that Kalimnik was essentially the guy opening the doors for Manafort when it came to oligarch power and potentially government connections in Ukraine and Russia. And a Mueller prosecutor, Andrew Weissman, said in a court hearing recently that this matter of Manafort allegedly handing polling data over to Kalimnik is central to the special counsel's investigation, and he basically said it was very important to what they were looking into, Russian interference and whether anyone with Trump knew about it. So Kalimnik really does look like a central figure in all this.
I'm speaking with Andrew Prokop of Vox about some of the key figures at the center of the Mueller investigation. Andrew, let's bring in another name here, someone else in Paul Manafort's orbit who agreed to a guilty plea with Bob Mueller. The name is Rick Gates. He has cooperated quite a bit. Where does he fit into all this?
So Gates was Manafort's sort of American right-hand man through all of this Ukraine work and worked very closely with Manafort and also came with Manafort to the Trump campaign. And when Manafort was dismissed from the campaign in August 2016, Gates stuck around, and Gates took a high-level role in planning Trump's inauguration as well, which is also something that's under investigation. Now, Gates flipped and struck a plea deal with Mueller about a year ago and has been cooperating ever since. He testified at Manafort's trial in Virginia, but he's also been providing other information. And he was, it seems, at this meeting with Kalimnik where Manafort handed over the polling data. So that allegation is in part based on what Gates has told investigators. So he's a very important witness in documenting what happened in 2016 and Manafort's role in it.
So, Andrew, I want to ask you, what really is there sort of a threat? I mean, there are other names here. There's the name Carter Page. There's the Internet Research Agency, other players that we have. We have about a minute left, and I'd love to get your thoughts on what the big takeaway is here. Is there a thread that we should be focusing on? The big picture here was to try and prove collusion.
I think what we've learned is that there was a lot going on in the 2016 campaign that was hidden from us and that wasn't known. Trump's talks about a Trump Tower Moscow that Cohen was involved in, this matter of handing a guy with Russian intelligence ties Trump campaign polling data, and whatever happened with Roger Stone and WikiLeaks. We don't yet know the full story, but what we are learning, I do think, is scandalous already, that all of these things were going on and that the American public had no idea about them.
Andrew Prokop is senior politics correspondent for Vox. Andrew, thanks so much for your insights.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, pop quiz. Who is Robert Mueller?
Robert Mueller was the gentleman who's investigating President Trump.
The guy investigating Russia?
The FBI person?
The guy dealing with the lawyer guy.
Robert Mueller. Who is Robert Mueller?
I have no idea.
No idea.
I have no idea.
I don't know.
No idea.
Who's Robert Mueller?
I just totally flipped James Comey and Robert Mueller in my head.
Some in the Trump administration, I'm pretty sure, right?
He's the special counsel who's investigating potential collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia.
If your head is spinning with all the details around Michael Cohen, Robert Mueller, and the whole cast of characters tied to Donald Trump, well, I don't blame you. There's a lot going on, and we need some answers. So we're taking your questions and putting them to Marcy Wheeler. She's an independent journalist who covers national security and civil liberties at emptywheel.net, and she's been following this investigation very closely. Marcy, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
So we asked our listeners to send us their question, and we got a range of issues from and questions from all across the country. People want to know whether there are possibilities for an indictment or an impeachment. And our first question from our listeners takes a look back at the Trump Organization's history. Let me play it for you.
Hi, my name's Kip Thorson. I'm from Tyler, Texas. I'd like to know, what did the Russians contribute to the Trump family's reemergence from near bankruptcy from the 1990s until 2010, and why have U.S. banks denied loans to the Trump Organization since that period?
Marcy, what do you have to say to Kip?
Well, this is a detail that I think Congress, including the House Oversight Committee, is going to unpack in the next couple of months. But Don Jr. has said that in the wake of those bankruptcies, U.S. lenders did stop lending to Trump. Deutsche Bank still lent money to them. But in addition, yeah, Don Jr. said that the Russians gave them a lot of money. And really critical for the story about the 2016 election is that Michael Cohen was negotiating a deal for a Trump Tower in Moscow, which was sort of too good to be true. But the gig was he was going to get $300 million just for putting his name on the largest tower in Moscow, largest tower in Europe. So when Don Jr. took that June 9th, 2016 meeting, the meeting where he was supposed to get dirt on Hillary Clinton, it was sold to him as part of basically a package of Russian support for Trump. And he would have known when he accepted that meeting that if he was nice to Russia, he and Dad would get a $300 million hotel deal out of it. And at the time, they were pretty underwater. They were pretty illiquid, as probably still are. And so there would have been no way they could have denied it. I mean, they really needed that kind of infusion.
We also got a couple questions from our listener text message service, and I'm going to read a couple of those to you. We got one from a listener in Lowell, Massachusetts. And the question is, quote, how long did the special counsel negotiate with Trump's lawyers to secure his written answers? And the listener from Lowell also wanted to know, did the special counsel seek to interview President Trump?
Yeah, Mueller did seek to interview Trump. There was at least a year-long negotiation starting in early 2018 and going through that entire year. Just after the elections, Trump gave written answers to Mueller. And then after Mueller received those written answers, he asked for a spoken follow-up, and Trump refused. You know, early on in the investigation, Trump's lawyers were like, yeah, sure, we'll do an interview. John Dowd, who quit, if I'm remembering correctly, March of 2018, basically said, I refuse to let you do an interview with Mueller because you're obviously going to botch it. So Trump's lawyers like to claim that Trump has been more cooperative than any president in history, and that's simply false.
I'm speaking with independent journalist Marcy Wheeler, and she's fielding your questions about all the different investigations into President Trump. Marcy, we got another call from a listener about how the president is handling this investigation. investigation, and this call comes to us from Hawaii.
Aloha, this is Orion calling from beautiful Maui. Who is paying Trump's legal bill for the probe? Thank you.
That's an interesting question. We haven't heard. I haven't heard a lot about that. I think a lot of people want to know where our or their or our tax dollars are going. I mean, who's paying for Trump's legal bills?
Right. Well, we are partly. So Trump has two sets of lawyers. One is his personal lawyers, and that includes Rudy Giuliani and Jay Sekulow and a couple from Florida. And Rudy, at least, is working for free. It's unclear who's paying Jay Sekulow and the couple. But in addition, Trump has a White House counsel lawyer who's in charge of Russian investigation and related issues. That guy's name is Emmett Flood. Unlike Trump's private lawyers, Emmett Flood is really good, and we're paying him. Because he's a White House counsel employee, we're paying him. However, just as an example, the predecessor to Emmett Flood was a guy named Don McGahn, and he gave reportedly 30 hours of testimony to Mueller. So there's those two things.
And just to be fair, we should also ask, who is paying for the special counsel's investigation? Is that also us, Marcy?
Well, it would be taxpayers, but because Paul Manafort had to forfeit $46 million as part of his plea deal last September, that more than pays for what the special counsel has spent so far.
We have another question from a listener who wants to know about the Mueller report itself, and it's something that we heard from a lot of listeners. So let's take a listen to the call.
My name is Sarah Berry. I'm calling from Portland, Oregon. I'd really love to know, if William Barr refuses to release the full Mueller report, what recourse do we have to make it public?
So, Marcy, we've heard that there's been a little bit of back and forth about whether or not Barr would release the report. What has he said specifically, and what happens if he does not release the report?
Well, before we even get there, I want to specify that it's unclear whether Mueller thinks of that report as the big outcome of his investigation. It is the report only is meant to be prosecutions and declinations memo. So in other words, he'll go to Bill Barr and say, I did not prosecute Carter Page, but I did prosecute Roger Stone, because obviously he's been in this business for 45 years. That's what the memo may look like. He's not done. He's still withholding information because of an ongoing investigation. So I'm not sure that he believes this report is his means of communicating information to the public. And as I've written, and now more and more people are writing, every time he submits any kind of prosecutorial document, with the exception of the Paul Manafort DC sentencing memo, he has provided way more information than he would need to do. So one should assume that is his preferred way of providing information to the public. I think that if there is a report that is focused on the president, Congress absolutely, or even just the president's immediate family and friends, I think Congress will have great standing to argue, because you can't indict the president, you have to give us any reporting that you have on why you could not indict the president. I just caution readers, I'm not sure the report is what we think it's going to be.
All right. Well, that's all we have time for. We want to thank all of our listeners who sent us questions on text and via voicemail. Marcy Wheeler has been taking your questions about all things Trump as his lawyer, Michael Cohen, testifies before Congress. She's an independent journalist at emptywheel.net. Marcy, thank you as always.
Thanks so much.
And that's our show for today. Always connect with us on Twitter. We're at The Takeaway, or join the conversation at The Takeaway's Facebook page. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.